lapse of time.
During the past week, it is estimated that some 30 million people have seen, and more millions have tried to see, in U.S. motion picture houses an historic film. The complete picture record of the bombing and sinking of the U.S. gunboat Panay by Japanese warplanes. In the new issue of Life, out tomorrow, appears a scene-by-scene record of this memorable incident. Taken by Universal Newsreel cameraman Norman Alley, who was aboard the Panay, these pictures were convoyed from China to the Philippines by four U.S. destroyers, in case Japan might try to seize the ship that carried them. From Manila, they were flown by China Clipper to the United States. Even while they were crossing the Pacific, Life secured exclusive magazine rights to the Panay pictures. From the thousands of pictures in this film, Life has selected 37 memorable scenes. Here in exclusive pictures, whose enlargement and fine printing clarify every detail, you will see the first Japanese plane flying directly over the Panay's mainmast. 2 minutes later, the smoking splash of a bomb in the water nearby. Caught and recorded in Life's 10th picture is the flashing split second of the film when a Japanese plane power dives down toward the U.S. flag on the Panay's stern. U.S. sailors, some half-clothed, man the Panay's old Lewis machine guns. The Japanese planes keep in line with the sun, blinding the gunners. 40 minutes later, the riddled, blood-spattered Panay slowly turns over and sinks. The survivors begin their slow 3-day trek back toward Nanking. In the new issue out tomorrow, Life presents this picture document of an incident which will remain a landmark in the history of American relations with the Orient in a form that can be studied and understood through each developing incident. It is a salient example of Life's primary purpose, through pictures, to inform.
Tonight, Life, the weekly magazine of pictures, joins Time, the weekly news magazine, in presenting by radio the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week.
From the March of Time.
The 10 best motion pictures of 1937. This week selected by 531 U.S. cinema critics for the 16th annual poll conducted by Film Daily, Movie Trade Journal. First choice of the 531 critics. In a 19th-century French courtroom.
Gentlemen of the jury, I know you. You are the heart, the intellect of my beloved Paris. I accompany you into your factories, your shops. Gentlemen, I swear that Dreyfus is innocent. By my 40 years of work, by all that I have won, by all that I have written to spread the spirit of France, I swear that Dreyfus is innocent. May all that melt away. May my name perish if Dreyfus be not innocent. He is innocent.
Thus, Paul Muni and Warner Brothers, Emile Zola.
Second choice, a peasant's hut in China.
There's a thing in me that hurts. And not hunger. But a man has no words.
No words, but I know.
O land, the earth has forgotten us. The earth, I hate it. I hate it.
No.
Soil and seed, I'll sell the land.
No, no, not the land. We'll not sell the land.
Thus, Paul Muni and Louise Reiner in MGM's The Good Earth.
Third choice. Midnight on the deck of a Gloucester fishing smack.
Your poor little fish, don't cry, don't cry.
I never heard that song before.
Me neither before. I just make him up.
Your poor little fish, don't cry no more.
How can a song be any good like that?
Oh, what's the matter with you? That's the best kind of song. When you feel good inside like you're trade winning, you just come out.
Oh, my beautiful lady, don't cry, don't cry.
But sometimes a song is so big and sweet inside, I can't get him out. So then I just look at the stars and maybe cry. I have so much fun.
Thus, Spencer Tracy and Freddie Bartholomew in MGM's Captain's Courageous.
Fourth choice, a sanctuary in Tibet.
To be candid, Father, a prolonged future doesn't excite me. I've often doubted whether life itself has any point. No, I'd need a more definite reason for its going on and on.
My son, we have a dream, a vision. When the world wearies of the eternal struggle and begins its blind search for solace and understanding, it will fall gratefully into the outstretched arms of Shangri-La. My son, I am placing in your hands the destiny of Shangri-La. For I am going to die.
Thus, Ronald Coleman and Sam Jaffe in Columbia's Lost Horizon.
Fifth choice, a Hollywood banquet hall.
And now I present the Motion Picture Academy Award to Miss Vicki Lester.
Ladies and gentlemen, when something like this happens to you, there are only two words that really mean anything. Thank you. All I can do is say them.
Hooray! That's fine. A very pretty speech, my dear little wife. And now I want to make a speech. I got one of those once for a best performance. They don't mean a thing. What I want is a special award. I want a statue for the worst performance of the year.
Thus, Frederick March and Janet Gaynor. In David Selznick and United Artists, a star is born.
Sixth choice, on a balcony in Verona.
Good night. Good night. Parting is such sweet sorrow that I shall say good night till it be morrow.
Sleep dwell upon thine eyes, peace in thy breast. Would I were sleep and peace so sweet to rest.
Norma Shearer and Leslie Howard in MGM's Romeo and Juliet.
Seventh choice. Backstage in a Manhattan theater on an opening night.
Every line she reads, I'm going to say, that should be Kay's line. And every move she makes, I'm going to say, that should be Kay. Kay, who's lying in a morgue, all broken and alone. Now I dare you to go on tonight.
I've got to get out of here. I'm not going on tonight.
You've got to go on. It's tradition in the theater.
Oh, hang the tradition of the theater. I'm thinking of Kay.
3 minutes to curtain, Miss Randall. 3 minutes to curtain.
All right, we're coming. We're ready.
Thus, Ginger Rogers, Katherine Hepburn, and Constance Collier in RKO's Stage Door.
Eighth choice. On the stairway of a tenement building.
Mom. Mom. How are you, Mom? Mom, it's me. I only have my face fixed.
You dog. You rotten yellow dog, you.
Do you need any dough?
Keep your blood money. You'll be needing it. The cops will get you soon enough.
Me? They won't get me. Not Martin. Not Babyface Martin.
Babyface. Babyface. I remember. I ought to be killed for giving you life. Murderer. Murderer.
Thus, Humphrey Bogart and Marjorie Maine in Samuel Goldwyn and United Artists, Dead End.
Ninth choice, a slum on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Now all you silent powers that make the sleet and dark and never yet have spoken, give us a sign. Let fall some mercy with the rain. We are two lovers here in your night, and we wish to live.
Why didn't they answer us?
They have answered. I was blind not to see. This is our answer. They sent us this.
Thus, Burgess Meredith and Margot in RKO's Winterset.
Tenth choice in a New York divorce court.
Now, Mrs. Warriner, in these divorce cases where a point of custody is involved, we frequently allow the final decision to rest with the party in question. Bailiff, unleash the dog.
Oh, come on, Smith.
Come on,
Smithy. Come on, Mr. Smith. Smithy. Come on, Smithy.
Look up here.
Come on, come on,
Della. Don't be anything.
Come on, Smithy. Come on, Mr. Smith. Oh,
well, I guess I win, don't I?
Thus, Irene Dunne, Cary Grant, and Asta the Pup in Columbia's The Awful Truth.
New York Film Critics Award for the Best Performances of the Year. Greta Garbo as Camille, Paul Muni as Emil Zola. And ranking first and second as America's favorite stars by box office standards, two cinema actors who do not appear in any of the year's 10 best cinemas, 8-year-old Shirley Temple and 37-year-old Clark Gable. 1938 marches on. Washington, D.C.
On the afternoon of January 3rd, the House of Representatives and the Senate, sitting in joint session, will reopen the 75th Congress of the United States.
But as Congress meets in its regular 1938 session to hear the voice of the President on the State of the Union, other more imperative voices are echoing this first week of 1938 over the length and breadth of industrial America.
2,000 Lynn, Massachusetts shoe workers take a 10% wage cut.
Haverhill factories reduce payrolls by 12.5%.
New Bedford textile workers forfeit 1/10 of their 98 income to keep the Neild mill from closing.
General Motors lays off 30,000 workers, relegates 200,000 to part-time work. Same day declares a dividend of $64 million.
U.S. employment census indicates 10 million U.S. unemployed, a figure estimated to be increasing at the rate of 500,000 per month.
National Industrial Conference Board President Virgil Jordan.
It's absurd to call this recession anything but what it is, a major depression. The country's in a thoroughly rotten shape due to partly to business and partly to persistently false economic thinking pursued by the United States government.
Assistant U.S. Attorney General Robert Jackson.
America is witnessing a general strike. Not a strike of worker against employer, but a strike of big business against the government. Immediate action should be taken to curb the abuses of power now being practiced by monopolies in finance and industry.
And with recession growing hourly more acute, with political voices raised in protest and accusation, the nation this week analyzes the number one pronouncement of the State of the Union in 1938, the annual message by Franklin Roosevelt to the Congress of the United States.
The President's message on agriculture.
Insistence on enactment of the New Deal Farm Program, shelved by the 1937 Emergency Congress.
On labor.
Insistence on enactment of the New Deal Wages and Hours Bill. Bitterly opposed by Southern congressmen, junked by the 1937 Emergency Congress.
On big business.
Insistence on measures to end monopoly price fixing, tax avoidance, and speculation. Insistence that industry's 1938 tax burden should not be lightened at the expense of the federal treasury.
This first week of 1938, as the president restates his consistent New Deal policies of 5 years, insists on social legislation and national defense measures, putting the U.S. budget for fiscal 1939 an estimated $1 billion out of balance. As the nation sees another Roosevelt insistence bear belated fruit, the retirement of conservative Supreme Court Justice George Sutherland, with a heretofore rebellious Congress visibly impressed by the firm Roosevelt stand, recalled is the president's own estimate of his speech on the State of the Union, reported this week by New York's Congressman Bertrand Snell.
After his message,
The president turned to me and said, "Well, Bert, as they used to say on the Lower East Side, that was not asking them, that was telling them."
Time marches on.
Scudding southward through the Pacific, 180 miles south of San Pedro, California, one night this week, is the 58-foot two-master schooner Afia. Asleep in their cabins below are three women, a small boy. But in their quarters, the two members of the crew. On deck at the helm are the Afia's owner and master, Dwight Faulding, and 42-year-old Jack Morton.
Want me to take the wheel for a while?
Oh, I'll keep it. Gotta come about in a minute.
Say, the stars never look this way on land, do they? Makes you feel like never going back.
Uh-huh. But we've gone about as far as we can on a 2 days cruise.
I suppose so. But you know, we could go on. We've got the women and the crew to help us. And there are islands down there. Islands nobody knows about.
Well, better come about, I guess. Want to slack off that jib sheet for me?
Hey, wait a minute. Faulding, listen. Do you know what I am back there? A houseboy, a servant. Yeah, me, Jack Morgan, a servant. I skipped and saved for this trip.
I wish we could stretch it out. Ready about? Watch your head.
No. No.
Morgan, put down that gun.
Keep that wheel where it is. We're not going back. We're going out to sea.
Listen, Morgan. I'm in command here. I'll tell you what...
No, I'm in command. I'm in command, and we're not going back. We're going out to sea. Everybody on deck! Everybody on deck!
Such is the strange beginning this week of a modern story of piracy and murder on the high seas. Two pistols in his belt, holding crew and passengers below decks, Pirate Jack Morgan steers the schooner Afia on an uncharted course for an unknown destination, plowing southward through the deep Pacific swells, hour after hour. In the cabin of Jack Morgan's wife.
Mrs. Morgan, what's going to happen? There's no food. He's going farther and farther out to sea.
I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, have you talked with your husband since...
Yes, he doesn't seem to hear me. It's as if he...
Runner!
What'll we do?
Shh! Runner, you've got to come up on deck. You've got to help me.
Just a minute, Jack.
Don't. He might...
I'd better go. Maybe I can do something. I'd better go.
In the crew's quarters, George Spurnack and Robert Horn sit on the edge of their bunks, looking upward at the deck overhead.
Listen to him. He's been walking that way for hours. Are you sure the old man's dead?
Yeah. He made me shove the body overboard.
I'll go the same way unless we do something.
What can we do? He's got the only guns aboard and he's crazy.
We're going further out to sea every hour. No food. I tell you, we gotta do it. Listen. He's still there.
It'll be daylight in another hour.
You gotta do it now.
Two shadowy figures slide noiselessly through the hatch, crouch in the deep shadows on deck, begin inching toward the wheel where Morgan is talking to his wife.
What about the dame? She's as scared of him as anybody. Come on.
You've got to learn to steer, Lillian. She's the only one I can trust. And you better not go back on me.
Jack, we can't go on. You can't let us all starve.
We'll get supplies in Mexico. Nobody's going to stop me now. Who's that? Who's that? Who's that?
Better rush him. He can't see us.
Let's go.
Let him have it.
Jack,
he dropped the gun. Bob, Morris, Mike, hit him. Hit him.
Stop it.
This week, after drifting for 8 days, the yacht Afia is picked up by the Coast Guard, towed into San Pedro Harbor, her deck spotted with the blood of two violent deaths. Deaths for which there can be no punishment. For under U.S. law, one essential proof of a murder is a corpse. And this week, the corpses of Dwight Paulding and would-be pirate Jack Morgan are lost somewhere in the 8,000-mile expanse of the Pacific Ocean. Time marches on. Rome, Italy. Into a huge high-ceilinged office in the Palazzo Venezia this week troops a smiling delegation of loyal fascist citizens. Stands back respectfully as a government secretary makes an announcement to Benito Mussolini.
Duce, the winners of the contest.
Good, good. Now come forward, please. Right up to my desk here. Don't be bashful. Ah, that's better. Now we can talk. Which is Signora Valente? Oh, isn't she here?
Yes, senor.
Ah, why should you be bashful, senor? You are the outstanding woman of Italy. 10 babies in 11 years, isn't that right?
Yes, senor.
I am proud to meet you. And which of you ladies is Signora Angelone?
Right here, Duce.
Oh, what city are you from, senor?
Oh, it's not a city, Duce. It's a farm. See, all 8 men come without a midwife. The midwife always gets there too late.
You are not the kind of a woman to wait for a midwife when she takes her time, no? And your name, senor?
I am Signora Rani. I have 13 altogether.
13 children. You are a fortunate woman. Is your husband with you, senora?
No, he is in Spain. I have wanted to ask you, Duce, when you will come back.
Oh, soon. Very soon, I hope.
Oh, but, senor...
Fascist women, fascist husbands, you have given real tokens of your true devotion to the state. Your government is great. I am great. And remember, signori, let il Duce know about it if your husbands forget how to treat you.
Wake, a frequently satirized feature of the totalitarian state, sees a real-life counterpart. As to 94 winners of the Mussolini More and Better Babies contest, go one life insurance policy, a cash bonus averaging $34.15 a baby, and the personal congratulations of father of 5 children, grandfather of 4, Benito Mussolini. Time marches on. Shanghai. Outside his home in the French concession one day this week, in his automobile sits Lo Pahong, Chinese industrialist and Catholic leader, known as the Rockefeller of China. Approaching the car are 2 fruit peddlers.
Oranges? Oranges? Will you please buy some of our oranges, venerable sir?
Oranges? Well, yes.
Thank you, kind sir. We give you the best we have from the bottom of the basket.
Here you are. A gun. Have you come to kill me?
Yes, but do not move, Lo Pahong. Traitor to your country. We will now plan to rebuild Shanghai so that you can trade with the Japanese, while millions of your countrymen have sacrificed their homes, their lives.
I, too, have sacrificed my mills, my warehouses.
Shanghai was destroyed by the blood of Chinese soldiers. If necessary, all China will be destroyed before it comes under the heel of the invader. And you...
Oh, no, no!
This week, across the plains of North and Central China, billows a cloud of yellow smoke, rolling up from the fires of blazing industrial centers and the burning huts of Chinese peasants. In Hangzhou and Xin'an, dynamite blasts power and utility plants. In Tsingtao, torch and dynamite reduce Japanese silk and cotton mills to ashes. Left blackened are the cotton fields of the lush Yangtze Valley, the wheat fields of Hefei and Suyan, the millet fields of Chahar, Shantung, and Shanxi, destroyed by the retreating forces of Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. To leave for the invader only ruins, broken tile and scorched earth. This week in Canton, Commander-in-Chief of the Chinese armies in South China, General Yu Hamu, receives New York Timesman Tillman Durden.
General Yu, what will you do if the Japanese turn to South China now and attack Canton?
It is merely a question of following a policy determined long in advance.
And what policy is that?
We call it, Mr. Durden, the policy of the scorched earth. If we are forced to abandon Canton, the entire city will be burned to the ground.
Burned to the ground? But Canton is one of the largest cities in the world.
Mr. Durden, China will never be conquered until every inch of it is under the sword of the invader. And that will not happen. Not in my lifetime, nor in that of my descendants. We can fall back 1,000 miles. We can harass the Japanese armies by guerrilla warfare for years. Even if an area nearly as large as your United States is taken from us, it will be but half of China. And that half will be dust and ashes.
This week, China's dictator Chiang Kai-shek resigns his premiership to reorganize a 170-division guerrilla army. To fight the invader with a man-made holocaust without precedent since the armies of Imperial Russia burned their cities and left for Napoleon Bonaparte only ashes and the long retreat from Moscow. For this week ahead, for the armies of Chiang Kai-shek, for the invading Japanese forces, for 300 million Chinese peasants, is the long winter and all the traditional plagues of China. Smallpox, diphtheria, typhus. In the coming spring, cholera, dysentery, malaria. And the most terrible of all China's plagues, famine. Over thousands of square miles of scorched and blackened Chinese earth. Time marches on. The pageant of the week's news. The story is dramatic, tragic, exciting, stranger than fiction. You have followed tonight on the march of time. It is this great news pageant of the world, the magazine Life, is unfolding every week before the eyes of its readers in pictures. Men and women like life. Youngsters like life. All kinds of people with all sorts of interests like this new magazine of pictures. Musicians, radio, screen, and stage stars like life. Says young violin prodigy Yehudi Menuhin.
Life pictures give me a genuine, first-hand, living experience of our world's current history.
Says Gertrude Lawrence.
Your magazine Life portrays life itself with deadly accuracy. It is a strong, vital, and necessary publication.
Says Cecil B. DeMille.
A source of information and entertainment, Life has won a distinct place in the homes of Americans.
Says Kate Smith.
Your magazine Life is great. Many of the photos in your picture reporting concern events, incidents, and facts that I have only read about, and which existed in my own mind merely as I conceived them. That's why I find untold enjoyment in perusing Life every week.
This week, 16 million American men, women, and children, 9 readers per copy, are looking forward to tomorrow's new Life. They recognize Life as the first responsible picture chronicle of our times. They find in Life the one responsible picture report of the news of the week and the life of the world. The new issue of Life is on sale tomorrow. News dealers have another 100,000 additional copies to start the new year. But many newsstands will be sold out by tomorrow night. So to make sure of getting your copy, we suggest you ask your news dealer for Life tomorrow, Friday morning.
This week in the new issue of Life, and also in Time, the weekly news magazine, a special service for motion picture goers. A listing of every one of the 8,200 theaters in the United States which plays the March of Time motion pictures. To make sure of seeing each monthly issue of the March of Time on the screen, get in touch with the manager of your local theater as listed this week in Life and Time. He is prepared to let you know each month the exact days each new issue is showing at his theater.
Time marches on.
Again next Thursday night at this same time, the March of Time. This is the National Broadcasting Company.